Welcome back to Shake Up Your Workup, your go-to veterinary podcast for daily diagnostics. In each episode, we'll dive into innovative diagnostics and real-world clinical practice to help practitioners navigate both typical and not-so-typical workups. In this episode of Shake Up Your Workup, Dr. Sylvia Conway sits down with Dr. Natalie Holt to explore whether early intervention can change the course of feline chronic kidney disease. They'll dig into the value of early detection, the role phosphorus plays in disease progression, emerging biomarkers like FGF23, and practical strategies for managing cats in IRIS stages 1 and 2. You won't want to miss this. Let's get started. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Shake Up Your Workup. I'm your host, Dr. Sylvia Conway, and our guest today is Dr. Natalie Holt. Natalie is an IDEXX Medical Affairs Specialist supporting renal health. The topic of today's podcast is In Pursuit of Health, Does Early Intervention Help in Feline CKD? Welcome to the show, Natalie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I know it's your first time with us, so you're not going to escape, I'm afraid, our little introductory question. So just to find out a little bit more about you and your background, Natalie, I wonder if you can tell our listeners what got you into veterinary medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. So my dad likes to tell this story about a time when I was 2 or 3 years old, and he was introducing me to one of his friends, and he said, she's going to be an engineer just like me when she grows up. And I immediately corrected him and said, no, Daddy, I'm going to be a veterinarian. And when I was in elementary school, I would go to the library and read books about the veterinary schools. And by the time I was 8, I had decided I would attend Tufts Veterinary School. Although when the time came, I was not accepted there, and I attended Kansas State Veterinary School, which was amazing. And I did end up at Tufts doing my residency in small animal internal medicine.
I mean, I think engineer, vet, not so different, just slightly different parts. Our parts,
exactly,
you know, are a little bit more squishy, have a little bit of more of a mind of their own, but I think it's relatable. So hopefully he's still very proud of the choice that you made.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. So today's topic is CKD, and more specifically feline CKD. So this is super common condition. Nasa, do you have any insights into how common this is in cats?
I think this is one of the most common disease of cats, and up to 40% of cats over the age of 10 will have some degree of CKD. I think as high as 50% over age 10 has been reported in some studies. And then once we hit the very geriatric cats, those that are over 15 years of age, it can be as high as 80%. So it's very common and something that we see regularly in veterinary practice.
Yeah. So, I mean, 80%, and our cats, I think, are living longer and longer because of all the advances in medicine and in care and in preventatives and all those other things. So we're seeing more and more of these aged cats. And if it's 80%, that's really a large number of the population that are being affected by this. So bearing that in mind, and this is a very kind of quite subjective and obscure question, I think in treating these cats, we're looking to make them happier and extend their lives because we can't cure CKD. But what are the benefits of starting treatment early? And how do we know that early treatment is going to make a difference to these animals?
In terms of outcome, the honest answer is that it varies, but in many cases, it will be meaningfully longer and better quality of life. So not longer life, but better quality of life and longer life. So cats diagnosed in these early stages can often live 3 years or more, especially if we're proactive about controlling the key drivers of progression, which are phosphorus, proteinuria, and hypertension. And if we compare that to cats with later stage disease, so cats that have already reached IRIS stage 3 or stage 4 and they're uremic, the survival time is more like months to maybe a year or two, depending on what complications are present. So when we say early, what we mean is before clinical signs, before azotemia, while the cat still looks and feels normal, that's our biggest opportunity window. And so we know that intervening in these early stages can significantly delay progression of disease, which improves survival and long-term quality of life.
And why do cats get CKD? Why is it so common in cats?
I mean, part of it is actually a success story. Just like in people, as cats get older, there's a natural decline in organ function, including the kidneys. And so the fact that we see so much CKD partly reflects the fact that we're keeping cats healthier for longer. So they're able to live into these senior years where we start to see these this disease become more common. Additionally, there are some individual risk factors in cats. Some cats have a genetic predisposition, like Persian cats and polycystic kidney disease. Others may have had earlier life insults to the kidneys, whether that's infectious diseases like FELV or FIP, episodes of urethral obstruction, or other sources of kidney injury. And there's some really interesting emerging ideas. One of them involves a protein called feline apoptosis inhibitor of macrophage, which help clears debris from kidney tubules. And in cats, it may not function the same way it does in other species, which could contribute to their increased susceptibility to kidney disease. So it's not just one thing. It's a combination of aging, genetics, lifetime exposures, and unique feline biology all coming together to increase the risk.
Those cats proving that they're special again. They've always got something a bit
cats,
different.
Man.
Throw us the curveball every time. Let's get this, you know. So let's roll back a little bit and talk about more of the basics of CKD. So can you just remind everybody listening, how do we define CKD and what are the various iris stages for CKD?
So chronic kidney disease is defined pretty simply. It's a structural or functional kidney abnormality that has been present for at least 3 months. And it can show up a few different ways because the kidneys do a lot of jobs. So we could have reduced filtration, which shows up as azotemia or just gradual increases in biomarkers over time. We could see loss of glomerular function, and in this case, cats might have persistent proteinuria, loss of tubular function, they may not be able to concentrate urine, and even structural changes, so cysts, stones, masses. And sometimes in later stages, you'll see these together, and in early stages, you might just have one of these abnormalities. And the stages themselves have numeric definitions, which would be more interesting to look up online at Iris Kidney. But by definition, our stage one cats are essentially have normal or near normal glomerular filtration rate, GFR. So that means most of the clinical signs classically associated with CKD aren't present yet. These cats are non-azotemic, but they may have evidence of kidney disease or glomerular disease on their lab work or imaging. Stage two cats can have biomarkers within reference intervals up to a mild azotemia, but they're often still clinically subtle. And then stage three and four have moderate to severe azotemia. And really that's where we're starting to see clinical signs and possibly in stage four, more overt uremic signs.
Got through the old glomerular tongue twister there. That's always
From now on, we'll call it GFR.
But it's easier, much easier. Let's stick with that. So talking about diagnosing, because obviously the staging is kind of the stage two, right? You diagnose the disease first and then you stage it once you've made the diagnosis.
Precisely.
So if we're looking to diagnose CKD, what are the tests that we absolutely have to run in our cats?
When it comes to diagnosis, the few things I would consider non-negotiable would be trending renal biomarkers over time. So that's creatinine and SDMA paired with a urinalysis that includes a urine-specific gravity and a dipstick for protein at the very least. And this combination, and not just one time, but over time, is really the backbone of diagnosis. So if the urinalysis suggests it, combining that with a urine protein to creatinine ratio can be part of making the diagnosis and treatment decisions. And then ultrasound isn't strictly mandatory, but it can be incredibly valuable, especially in the earlier or less straightforward cases. And for example, in iris stage one, you can actually make the diagnosis of early kidney disease based on structural changes found on ultrasound. Beyond that, the ultrasound gives you insight into what might be driving the disease. So do we see asymmetry? Is there mineralization, obstruction, et cetera? And so while you can diagnose CKD without imaging, it really helps you understand the why behind the disease. And that's prepares you to explain the disease process more to the owner and make decisions tailored to that patient about best next steps.
I might need to talk a little bit about thyroid, I think, in this conversation, because these are primarily, well, it's cats we're talking about, and a lot of these are older cats where we know that hyperthyroidism is very, very common. Would you always measure T4 in these cats as well as the basic tests that we've discussed, because that's going to also affect their renal perfusion?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, if we think of the classic hyperthyroid cat, it's pretty easy to recognize. They're losing weight. They eat really well. They meow a lot. They can be restless, PUPD. And so in those cats, obviously a T4 is a no-brainer. But the tricky part is that not every cat reads that book, and some don't show those classic signs, especially earlier in the disease. And the current guidelines, for example, the AHA guidelines recommend that we strongly consider routine thyroid testing in apparently healthy mature adult cats, so including T4 as part of routine screening, which helps us pick up trends earlier. And that is a repeated trend. You need to pick up trends earlier for many things, thyroid and kidney, so that we can identify the disease before it becomes clinically obvious. And catching thyroid disease early also matters, because the hyperthyroidism can complicate or even mask underlying kidney disease. So it might hide the kidney disease while progressing it at the same time.
Yep. So make sure you're trending your values on your preventative or wellness screens, and any changes, just kind of digging into those and making sure it's not early CKD or hyperthyroid disease if your T4s. Mm-hmm. Okay. Brilliant. So let's talk about progression of the disease. So I think that in recent years, we've changed our attitude towards this slightly, and it's now seen, kidney disease kind of seen as more of a spectrum type of disease. Can you explain to us sort of how CKD tends to progress in cats?
Yes, that's another great question, because we often picture CKD as this smooth, predictable decline, but clinically that's not what we see. The reality is that most cats end up in a very similar place, but they get there through different pathways. So a cat may experience repeated small insults, which are minor events that damage nephrons, maybe minor dehydration episodes, brief hypotensive episodes, subclinical inflammation. And each of these episodes on its own doesn't look dramatic, and the kidney partially recovers, but not quite back to baseline. And over time, what you see is this slow, almost invisible drift downward in GFR. Other cats may experience fewer but larger insults. So the same basic mechanism, but bigger events, like a more significant hypoperfusion episode or a toxin exposure. And each of these takes a bigger bite out of the renal function. And when there's recovery, even though there may be some recovery, the new normal is sort of stepping down. So the decline becomes more obvious and it's more rapid. What another pattern we see is an ongoing sustained injury. So there isn't really a recovery phase in this type of kidney disease. Instead of discrete hits, we've got more of a continuous process. Maybe this is inflammatory, hemodynamic, or toxic, but it's persistently damaging that kidney. And this curve looks smoother, but the end result is the same: progressive loss of functional kidney mass. And then there's also our classic acute kidney injury to chronic kidney disease transition, where we have a single severe event. You see a sharp drop in function followed by some degree of recovery. And in the moment, the key question in these cases is, where are they going to land? Will they go back to baseline? Will they stabilize at a lower level with fewer nephrons? But when you step back, all of these situations have a unifying theme, which is maladaptive repair. So it's not just the injury that matters. It's how completely and how well the kidney recovers following that injury.
Okay. So, I mean, as veterinarians, obviously what we want to do is to preserve the kidney function as long as possible, keep these cats as healthy for as long as possible. So this podcast is about early intervention. So we're talking about intervention stage, IRIS stage one and two, I'd assume. What can we do in those stages that are going to make a difference and that are going to help these animals preserve their kidney function and prevent such rapid progression?
Well, the cornerstone of treatment for kidney disease has been for quite some time a phosphorus-reduced diet. And when we talk about phosphorus-restricted diets or renal diets, the traditional teaching has been pretty clear. We start those consistently in IRIS stage three and beyond. This is where the evidence has been strongest and where it is universally recommended for all cats. But when it comes to our early CKD cats, IRIS stage one and IRIS stage two cats, though, things are a little more nuanced. And honestly, that's where there's a lot of current discussion happening. Because the reality is, these are the cats that live the longest. This is exactly where early intervention can have the biggest impact. And if we want to keep a cat stable in IRIS stage one or IRIS stage two for longer, we really can change the disease trajectory. So in these early stages, a renal diet becomes a very reasonable treatment option, especially if you're starting to see early markers of risk, like an elevated FGF23 or elevated urine protein to creatinine ratio. And we have some really interesting data here. So a large study with nearly 1,500 cats in IRIS stage one and two showed that cats started on a renal diet in the early stages had about an 11-month delay in progression and a roughly 20% increase in survival time compared to cats that were not on a renal diet at that stage. And that's clinically meaningful. And one of the common concerns is, are we starting too early? And this particularly surrounds the concern for hypercalcemia, which is a valid concern, because we know that some population of IRIS stage one cats that get started on a phosphorus-reduced diet become hypercalcemic. But so far, the data is somewhat reassuring. And one study didn't find an increase in all-cause mortality in those cats that developed hypercalcemia. And another found no significant impact on disease progression in those cats either. So where does that leave us? I think the key takeaway right now is monitoring matters. So if you're starting a renal diet early, just make sure you keep an eye on the calcium and the phosphorus. But stepping back, I think this is an evolving area. And as a profession, we're still learning. And I wouldn't be surprised if over time we see the recommendations shift towards earlier dietary intervention in CKD.
So phosphorus is the problem. This is a bit of a three-pronged question here. So I wonder if you can explain to our listeners, just in simple words, what the issue is with phosphorus for cats, why we need to control that. And then the sort of other parts of this question is, when should we test FGF23? When is that helpful? And when is a phosphorus binder helpful?
So phosphorus is central to CKD progression. It's not just about the serum phosphorus number we see on chemistry results, but what happens is as GFR starts to decline, the phosphorus will rise and the body has a compensatory mechanism for that. The first step of that compensatory mechanism is an increase in FGF23. And the role of this is to push out more phosphorus through the kidneys and at the same time suppress calcitriol. That, in turn, removes a normal brake on parathyroid hormone. And so parathyroid hormone rises to help keep calcium and phosphorus in a normal range. And so this is all a compensatory mechanism. Phosphorus rises, we have this mechanism, and then phosphorus returns to where it started. But as CKD progresses, these compensatory mechanisms start to fail and you end up getting overt hyperphosphatemia and secondary hyperparathyroidism. And clinically, one take home from this mechanism is that FGF23 will rise before serum phosphorus does. And that's why we can use it to identify patients in early stages that have phosphoruses below the clinical decision point of 4.5 milligrams per deciliter who might benefit from an early transition to a renal diet. Phosphate binders typically don't come into play until much later. So a phosphate binder would be considered once a cat is already on a renal diet and the phosphorus is still creeping up above those clinical decision limits for their stage of disease.
That was so incredibly well explained. I feel like I was looking at a diagram when you were explaining that. That was incredible. So fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about managing these cats from a practical standpoint. So if I've got a cat that I've diagnosed as IRIS stage 2, it's stable, it's actually eating a renal diet and it's doing well on that, it actually enjoys its food. How commonly do I need to be rechecking that animal and what should I be rechecking?
In an ideal world, you could probably check these cats every 4 months, but in reality, I think every 6 months is a little bit more practical, and that's still a reasonable standard for stable patients. You can increase that frequency sort of based on the individual. So later stage cats or those on medications like antihypertensive, they may need to be seen more often. But our goal with that twice yearly recheck is pretty focused because we want to catch changes in proteinuria, monitor blood pressure, keep an eye on body weight and lean muscle mass, which is something owners may not be perceiving at home, and then watch for trending of their renal biomarkers. And it's really about finding that balance. We want to be frequent enough to catch those meaningful changes, but not so frequent that it becomes overwhelming to the owner.
And blood pressure, you know, we know we're supposed to be doing blood pressure in these cats. In reality, that isn't always very easy. Do you have any tips on how to get good blood pressure measurements in these cats?
It could be absolutely impossible to get blood pressure accurately in some cats. So I think we just need to acknowledge that you can have all the tips in your toolbox and it still might not happen. But the biggest thing to keep in mind is setting the cat up for success. So ideally, they should spend 10 to 15 minutes in a quiet, dim room before you even think about getting a blood pressure. And a blood pressure should be taken before any other handling in that visit. If the cat comes in a carrier, I'll often just take the top off and let the cat stay in the carrier. And our goal is really minimal, gentle, cat-friendly handling, ideally zero restraint if you can get away with it. And a few technical points that really matter is to always measure the cuff size, which should be about 30 to 40% of the limb circumference. We don't want to tape those cuffs closed because it can impact the readings. And we want to pick the limb that is most at heart level. Tail base can also be used. And the tail can work really well, especially in cats that don't want to be handled. Maybe they have arthritis or, you know, some cats just don't like their feet touched. And so it's a little bit of an art, but with the right setup and technique, it becomes more achievable. But still acknowledging it can be challenging.
Good old cats again. Talking about owner compliance now. So this is, it says it in the name, it's chronic kidney disease. So this is a condition that the owner is going to have to live with, the cat's going to have to live with. Do you have any tips on getting owners on board with compliance in terms of getting the cats to eat their food, take their meds if that's relevant, but also to come back for rechecks, to kind of be looking for signs that the disease might be progressing and then getting them back in front of us so that we can take the necessary steps to minimize the progression or the impact of that. So what would be your tips to kind of get owners or the pet owner on board for this long-term care that they're going to have with these patients?
I mean, honestly, the owners probably have the hardest job in all of this because we're asking them to do two things that are notoriously difficult in cats. One is getting them to eat a renal diet consistently, and cats just have strong preferences about their diet choices. Side note, that is one of the reasons that early CKD makes it easier to change diets while their appetite hasn't been impacted yet. The other thing we're asking them to do is to give medications. And that might be for proteinuria, that might be blood pressure medications, it might be to control phosphorus. And as we know, this is no small feat in a feline patient. I mean, it's almost impossible for me to give my own cat a pill. It takes two people. And then to try to do that more than once a day or more than one day in a given week or month, it's just a real challenge. And because of that, caregiver fatigue is very real for owners with chronic kidney disease cats. These are long-term cases. The day-to-day management really can wear people down over time. So part of our role as veterinarians is just to simplify and support as much as we can. But there are really some impactful things owners can do at home. First, optimize hydration. Owners can feed wet food when possible, provide multiple water sources, so bowls, water fountains, providing them in different locations. My cats love to drink out of the fish tank. That's their preferred location. Second, they're really acting as our home monitoring system. And so I think setting them up for that, like you are our early warning system, that's incredibly valuable. And so it's not just giving them the diet and giving the medications. It's really, let's keep an eye on the appetite, the body weight, the overall behavior, and then giving them discrete early warning signs like reduced appetite or an increase in vomiting, lethargy. And in many ways, some owners are happy to be the early detection system between visits because they are the ones that will notice these subtle changes first, especially if we help identify them. And making this a partnership gives us the opportunity to intervene and keep these cats stable for longer.
So we all love our cats. I think we can agree on that. I've seen your little friendly furry friends in the background there, Natalie, popping up through this recording. I think we'd all love our cats to have nine lives. Unfortunately, that is not the reality. So we need to take care of them for as long as possible and make sure that our little friends are living as long as possible. So just to wrap up here, Natalie, I wonder if you could tell us, what are your top tips in terms of approaching early CKD in felines?
Yeah, great question. My first tip is to trend early and trend often. Don't wait for azotemia. Owners often don't see the value of normal blood work. They are looking for a return on their investment, and to them, that means finding a problem. But I like to reframe that and say normal blood work in a healthy pet is the return on investment. It gives us a baseline that allows us to detect disease earlier and act sooner as our pets age. Tip two, feed for the future, not just for the present. Renal diets in early stage cats can slow progression and extend survival. So this is prevention, not just treatment. Tip three, phosphorus is a driver. It's not just a number. So start thinking about phosphorus early and include FGF23, even when labs look normal, because this is a cue to act sooner and institute diet therapy. Tip four, measure what matters, blood pressure and urine protein to creatinine ratio. These are treatable and impactful. And if you're not measuring them, you're missing opportunities. And tip five, turn owners into your secret weapon. They're your eyes and ears at home. Teach them to watch appetite, weight, and behavior and call you if there's any concerns.
Thank you so much for being a guest today, Natalie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sylvia.
Thanks for tuning in. This episode was hosted by Dr. Sylvia Conway and produced by me, Isolde Schroeder, with consulting producers Hannah Fries and Kate Benjamin. Check Up Your Workup aims to share helpful information and guidance. However, listeners are cautioned that diagnostic recommendations or discussions shared during this episode may not be applicable to every situation, and regulations regarding diagnostics and treatment may vary by region. Listeners should always consult with their own veterinarian or qualified animal health professional before making any decisions regarding any diagnostics, treatments, or patient care. To learn more about the topics discussed today, check out the episode description for links to resources and free online courses on the IDEXX Learning Center. And follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode of Shake Up Your Workup. We'd love to hear from you. You can share your comments, feedback, or questions by emailing us at shakeupyourworkup@idexx.com. And always, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be here next month when we shake up your workup with automated blood morphology from smear to solution.